shit. There's something I wasn't expecting. Is that what you remember? Or is that what you were told by the therapists? Therapists? Fuck them. They get in your head and tell you what's real and what's not. They don't know shit. I hold up the photo of his mural again. Who is he? What did he do to you? He's a fucking ghost. What's that mean? Artis looks into space as he thinks it over. I give him a moment. Clearly, he's buried this deep inside. He glances at the sheet again, his voice almost inaudible. They told me I made it up. They called me a liar. I was just a kid. I wouldn't have known how to make up something as fucked up as that. How fucked up? Chapter 23. White Car. Artis has his head cupped in his hand as he stares at the table and recounts his experience with the toy man. I keep my mouth shut and just let him talk. I get the feeling that this is the first time he's articulated what happened as an adult. While some details may fade, the passing of years can also bring on a deeper understanding of what actually happened. The first thing I realize is that Artis's dates are fuzzy. Although I'll never know exactly when he first ran into the toy man, a quick bit of math reveals that it probably happened between 6 months and a year after Christopher Bostrom went missing. Given the pained expressions on Artis's face, I can tell the memories remain vivid. Even before I saw him, I heard kids talking about the toy man all the time. He was supposed to be this dude who'd drive around in a big white Cadillac and roll down his window and ask if you'd been a good boy or not. If you said yes, he'd give you $5, or maybe some action figure or something. Then he'd tell you it was a secret. He didn't want the other kids getting jealous. Of course, kids being like they are, everyone talked. They'd whisper to you, "Have you heard of the toy man?" They'd ask if you'd ever met him. Some kids would even lie because they didn't want to miss out. I never had shit, so you can imagine how excited I was about the idea of the toy man rolling up next to me. I swear I even stood on sidewalks, staring at every white car, hoping it was the toy man. Then one day, I'm walking down 120th, and along comes this big white caddy. "You there!" he yells out at me. Deep voice. Deep motherfucking voice. "Have you been a good boy?" "Hell yes," I tell him. And just like that, he waves $5 at me. I walk up to the window, and he reaches out and grabs my hand. Gentle but firm, and pulls me closer. He looks me in the eyes and asks again if I've been a good boy. I say, "Yes, sir." He asks my name, where I live, and then gives me $5. He says keep it a secret, then drives away. I'd never had $5 in my life. You would have thought I'd won the lottery. I went straight to the 10-cent candy section in the store and bought me one of everything I could. I remember sitting on a bench eating all that candy, thinking that was the best day of my life. I was a dumb little fucker. For $5, he bought me. For days I kept hoping he'd show up again. Finally he pulled up again in that caddy and asked me if I'd been a good boy. I said, "Yes, sir." He then said he heard that I told some other kids he'd given me $5. I started bawling, saying at first that it wasn't true, those other kids were liars. Then I told him it was true, and I promised I would never tell anyone again. Well, he started to drive away, and to me it felt like Santa Claus flying right past your house. Then, all of a sudden, his brake lights come on, and it's like Santa changed his mind. The passenger door opens up, and I hear his voice ask me, "Do you want to go to Toyland?" I had no motherfucking idea what that meant, but I knew I sure as hell wanted to go there. So I say, "Yes, please, Mr. Toyman." And he says I have to get down on the bottom of the floor in his car, because he's going to have to sneak me into Toyland, because kids ain't allowed. I was 9, man. That shit made sense. I wasn't thinking this was so he could keep me from knowing where the hell we were going. It could have been minutes. It could have been hours. I was so excited I didn't care. Finally, he says I can get out. We're in Toyland. I opened the door, and sure as hell, I'm in motherfucking Toyland. I know it was a garage now, but back then, it might as well have been the North Pole. There was walls full of action figures, games, a whole fucking toy store. Plus, there were balloons and music. He led me into another room, where a big screen TV was playing cartoons. Another one had video games. He let me play as much as I wanted. I remember he gave me some juice to drink, and I felt a bit weird. I was thinking it was just the way you felt in Toyland. Artis catches his breath. So I play those games, and he does stuff, grabbing me like it's a game. I was laughing and having fun. I didn't know what was going on. His face takes on a tortured look. I was just a kid. Nobody ever gave me any attention. My stomach is churning. I'm sorry, man. Sorry for bringing it up. He looks at me funny. Shit, that ain't the real bad part. Fuck, I had counselors in juvie pull that kind of shit. It's where it went from there. After he'd grabbed my dick and all that, he had me get back in his car and hide down on the floor, and he took me back to where I was picked up. Now, another kid, he'd mentioned the toy man grabbed him and all that. Some other kids called him a faggot, so I made sure that I kept my mouth shut. The toy man picked me up again a few days later. He asked if I told anyone. I said I hadn't. This time he believed me. He said he was going to take me to Toyland again and had me crouch down on the floor of the caddy like the last time. When we got to his place, he offered me some more red punch. But I remembered the last time I drank it, I couldn't play Super Mario Kart worth shit, so I pretended to drink it, but actually dumped it on the floor. I was sitting in a game chair, playing, when he comes in the room and tells me he wants to take me to a special room only the best boys get to go to. I remember asking him what was in there. He said he had a surprise just for me. So, of course, I followed him. We went into his backyard, and there was this garage. We went inside, but it was all dark. I was scared, but Mr. Toyman told me it was okay. He turned on some music, and it was real loud. I could feel him shuffling around in there. We were standing on something like a gym mat, and every time he moved, it slid a little. The light comes on, and... holy shit. Artis closes his eyes. Mr. Toyman is standing there buck-ass naked in front of me. The first thing I notice are all these scars on his body. Fucked up shit. Then I see he's got a knife. A big-ass OJ knife. Worst thing, though, was the look on his face. Scariest thing I ever seen. He's always been this smiling, happy guy. This was like a demon took over. I didn't even notice the first cut. Artis makes a striking motion across his chest. I had on some baggy hand-me-down shit, so it didn't go in all that deep. But deep enough. I ran for the fucking door. Toyman must have thought he locked it, or was too drunk to move fast. I don't know. Artis pauses for a moment, his breath coming more quickly, his gaze far away. Then he smiles. Man, I was out that door and across his yard faster than a cat on fire. He had a fence, but I was a good climber. I remember the sound he made when he hit it like a rhino. Boom! He yelled, "Come back! It's just a game!" Bullshit. I wasn't that dumb. I kept running and running until I came to a bus stop, and some Mexican lady started screaming when she saw me. Next thing you know, I'm in an ambulance, and some cop is asking me what happened. I told him I was in Toyland, and a monster took over Mr. Toyman. So, of course, they thought I was nuts. A couple of days later, they had me drive around in an unmarked car and tell them which house it happened at. But I couldn't say. When I ran, I just ran. I never looked back. Counselors decided it was some gang initiation thing, and I was lying. Nine. There are some hardcore motherfuckers out there, but there wasn't no baby gang doing that kind of shit then. But they believed what they wanted to believe. Eventually, so did I. I speak for the first time in several minutes. I'm sorry to put you through that again. So, when you painted the picture of him. That was me trying to warn kids, I guess. But the truth is, I didn't remember much. Little things would come back to me now and then, even years later, like the smell of that garage. Shit died in there. And other things. There were jars of shit on the walls. I don't know what, but it wasn't goddamn peanut butter. He lets out a long exhale. And there you go. Artis versus the Toy Man. Jesus Christ. It's all I can say. Don't feel bad for me. Feel bad for all the little brothers who didn't want to cheat at Mario Kart. And you never found the house again? He shakes his head. When I got older, I'd drive around trying to find it with a gun in my lap, looking for that white caddy. I never found it. I don't know how far I ran that night. It couldn't have been that far. I was bleeding heavy. But far enough for the cops to not find him. Do you remember anything? Houses? Landmarks? Sort of, but it's all jumbled. What if there was a way to retrace your steps? What do you mean? There can't be that many houses that match that description with the garage and the fence. If you got some photos, I'll look at them. I think for a moment. We may have something better. Chapter 24. Simulation. An hour north of Barstow, California, there's a city that looks like something in Afghanistan. Complete with markets, mosques, and even a soccer stadium, it could be mistaken for a thousand places in the Middle East with its desert backdrop. Located at Fort Irwin, it was built to train U.S. soldiers before they're deployed overseas. There are similar training facilities at other bases, including a 300-acre city in Virginia used for practicing urban counterterrorism tactics. It even has a partial subway. Since the War on Terror began, we've spent billions of dollars building simulations of the places where we might have to send troops. Some of these simulations are virtual. When I went to work for OpenSky AI, I was given access to an urban threat assessment tool that's basically Google Earth from the future. Somewhere in the Northeast, there's a server farm with high-resolution images of every square foot of America and other countries, complete with in-depth data that effectively creates a 3D model of whatever you want to look at. I can pull it up on my phone. As Artis relates certain details, I run a script that finds matches for what he said. We already know the bus stop where he was found. The next step is identifying the house. I pull up the six closest candidates and create a 3D run-through for him to watch. The first-person perspective is accurate, even down to his height at the time. I push my phone against the glass and play the locations through for him. The first four don't get much of a reaction. It's the fifth one that tells me we have a hit by the way his pupils dilate.
"That's the motherfucking house!"
he yells, getting a stern look from a guard who's about to call our session to an end. He lowers his voice. "God damn it. If I wasn't in here..." It's probably a good thing that he is. I'm not sure what he'd do to whoever opened that front door. In his shoes, I'm not sure what I would do either. "Artis," I say, to get his attention. "It's possible this may not be the house." He glares at me.
"Don't be like them. Don't be like them."
"I'm just saying. Time changes things. The Toy Man may not even live there anymore. There's also the chance that Artis concocted all this. I can't fully rule that out." Instead of getting angry, he just nods.
"So now what? Call the cops? They'll believe you."
"You overestimate the credibility I have with them. I can't just call 911 and tell them I have the location of the Freddy Krueger of Compton based on the testimony of an inmate at county." He lets out an exhausted sigh.
"It's like when the Grim Sleeper was icing all those hookers. One of them even told the cops where it happened."
"She was wrong by one house," I point out.
"And that made all the difference in the world. So what are you going to do? Write an angry tweet? Tell all your white liberal friends how you helped out the poor black boy?"
I was going to go knock on the front door. Artis stares at me without blinking those penetrating gray eyes.
Are you fucking nuts?
It's not like I'm a 9-year-old kid. If he invites me inside, I'll decline. But I'm betting he's long gone.
Why is that?
Because you got away. If he's smart, he stayed clear of the house for a while and then moved a few months later.
To where?
I think he stayed in the general area, not too far away.
So how do we find him?
Housing records, utility bills. If this was his house, then he had to leave a trace.
Yeah.
Artis thinks for a moment.
There's one other thing about him. I couldn't quite describe it when I was a kid, but it makes more sense now.
What's that?
He talked funny. Kind of like a white guy, but not. Like he wasn't from here.
New York? He shakes his head.
I didn't know accents back then. There was street talk and TV talk. I learned both. One to talk to my friends, the other to talk to any adult who could make my life difficult in a facility.
He pauses again.
Man, I don't think you should be just rolling up there. Wait for me to get out and we'll both go.
When is that going to happen?
Maybe if you can say I helped get the toy man sooner. Nobody got hurt. It was all a misunderstanding.
I'm not sure if I buy that, but that's not for me to decide. I have to get something, some kind of proof. Otherwise it won't mean anything.
Yeah, well, once you do, we can show them this.
Artis lifts up his shirt and shows a huge scar that goes from his hip to his shoulder.
Holy shit. You got that straight?
How the fuck did you get away?
Fear, man. Fear. It's your best friend.
He pauses for a moment.
But you know that, don't you?
I'll show you mine another time. Artis shakes his head and glances around furtively.
Don't say that in here.
Oops. Sorry.
Let me know what happens. If you don't, I'll just assume the toy man got you. Whatever you do, don't drink the red punch.
Artis has slipped back into his jovial persona, which I guess is a good thing for his sanity's sake.
You'll never beat Bowser in Mario Kart.
Noted.
Seriously, watch yourself. Don't think just because you survived one monster, you'll survive the next. I'm alive because I kept running from them, not to them.
As he walks out of the visiting area, I take heed of his advice. The toy man went from a mathematical curiosity to a very real possibility in just a few days. Artis could be messing with me, like those kids back at Rico's house. He might just be a skillful liar who knows how to tell you what you want to hear. Although the only benefit in it for him that I can see is if he's telling the truth. Finding the toy man might help his case and get him out. I don't know if that's overall a good thing for society, but I get the feeling if his life hadn't been such a shit show from the start, he wouldn't be in here. Chapter 25. Deed. The title to 17658 Wimbledon has had four owners since it was built. From 1986 to 2005, it belonged to Kevin and Trudy Harrison. From 2005 to 2011, it belonged to a Jeffrey L. Washington. This was the toy man period. Currently, it is owned by Newcastle Property Management. While normally I would have experienced a eureka moment at discovering the name of the homeowner, I'd already discovered in exploring South Central property records that the name on the deed may not be the real name of the person who purchased the home. There are lots of homes owned by shell companies or people of record who are either fictitious or have no idea their name is on the deed. The house was paid for by Jeffrey Washington in an all-cash transaction. Trying to find anything about Jeffrey L. Washington turned out to be fruitless. I strongly suspect that he does not exist. I couldn't find any example of another Jeffrey L. Washington buying a home in the area after that time. Maybe he moved on, but it's more than likely an alias. Still, it's not a dead end by a long shot. There are all kinds of records, from utility bills to phone calls, that may still be out there for the finding. While I don't have ready access to them, if I can get something strong to connect Artis and Christopher to the property, I might be able to convince even someone as cynical as Detective Corman. But I won't hold my breath. My next best bet is to talk to the neighbors. The toy man had two of them that might have seen something. Of course, this still being South Central, there's a good chance nobody's going to tell me a thing. After I've done my background search into the house, I give William a call. I don't want him to start kicking in doors, or worse, tell Mathis that we have a suspect, so I just tell him I've been running down some leads and will have more to tell him. Soon, I hope.
"What was that about the toy man?" he asks.
I figure I can at least tell him that much. It's an urban legend some of the kids tell. He pops up every few years.
And does he have anything to do with Christopher?
Maybe. I think he might be a real man. I don't want to tell William that this guy was a kid fiddler and a killer, but he can fill in the blanks.
And you think he may have messed with Chris? He says flatly.
It's a possibility. Some of these guys like to groom kids, see which ones they can foster trust with. He just sighs, then says after a long moment,
I wanted it to be just some random guy. You know, a drifter who just spotted him.
I know. Maybe it was. It's just a story. I'm going to spare him Artis's harrowing tale until I know that there's more to it. We hang up with a promise from me that I'll keep him up to date, which isn't exactly sincere, considering the fact that I'm just a block away from the house where I think his son may have been murdered. I've driven around several times, watching the house until the scattered streetlights come on and bathe the neighborhood in a jaundiced glow. I noticed that all the other houses had yard lights triggered by photo sensors, but 17658 did not. With the exception of a faint light coming through the front curtain of the tan, one-story house, the property remains completely dark. That's not the only peculiar thing. The tallest fence I could find in the neighborhood is 6 feet. The one at 17658 measures 8, preventing anyone from looking over. There were also lines of shade trees in the backyard visible from the front of the house. While being located in the middle of a suburb, it feels oddly remote and secure. The fence stretches from the sides of the house to the next property about 10 feet away on either side. On the aerial view, the house sits on a long lot, going all the way back to a service road. The garage, perhaps the one Artis described, sits at the far end. The other garage, the one built into the house, has a lock on the outside and doesn't look like it's opened often. The biggest mystery to me is the identity of the owner. The house was sold in 2011 for about 20% under the going rate in the area, suggesting that it was a private sale, possibly from a homeowner in a hurry, or between two parties that knew each other, maybe even the same individual. This is what is making the hair on the back of my neck stand on end. Jeffrey L. Washington could still own the home. He could even be in there right now. Before I get out of my car, I consider my options, of which there aren't that many. The first is to drive to the airport and call Corman with what I know. But unless the toy man answers the door buck naked and covered in blood with a knife in his hand, there's not a lot Corman can do beyond a more wide-reaching record search. Chances are the toy man has erased anything that could connect him to the murders, if he's smart. After Artis got away, that would have been the prudent thing. Of course, we're talking about a serial killer. He may have a very different idea about what prudent means. I decide I just have to nut up and go knock on the door. I push my Glock and its holster into the back of my jeans, under my jacket. Even after my altercation with Joe Vick, I'm not a big gun guy, but thanks to some clever legal interpretation of our Department of Defense security agreements at OpenSky AI, I'm allowed to carry anywhere in the U.S., although a local judge might discourage it.
The question is whether I'm willing to use the gun. Scratch that. It's whether I'll even be in a situation where I have to. I give the yard another check, then walk up to the door at 17658 and knock. From inside the house, I hear a television being turned down and a dog barking. Well, at least somebody is home. Chapter 26 Bloodhound. The door opens a crack, and a small gray ball of fur comes shuffling out of the house and plants itself at my heels, yapping a warning that I need to vacate the property immediately.
Eddie! Shouts an old woman from inside. Leave him alone!
The dog darts back inside, satisfied that he's done his canine duty. When the door opens wider, I see a short, elderly black woman with large glasses looking up at me.
Yes?
She asks. I catch a glimpse inside the house to make sure that there's no naked serial killers ready to come lunging at me, other than Eddie. Hi, I'm Theo Cray. I show her my ID, which she grasps and holds on to for a closer look.
That's not a very good picture, Mr. Cray, she says after letting go.
I'm not very photogenic.
Come in,
she offers, holding the door open for me.
Would you like some tea?
Okay. I step inside, suspiciously glancing at the space behind the door, wary that I might be walking into something. The house looks like the furnishings haven't been changed since Clinton was in office. Wood paneling covers the walls of the living room. A large couch sits in front of a big-screen television that appears to be from the Toy Man's era. As she shuts the door, I notice three rows of locks, and one on the inside requiring a key. This sets off an alarm in my head. That's the kind of lock you use to keep somebody inside. I watch as she goes into the kitchen and pours two cups of tea. The floor is scratched up and the carpet bare in spots.
I was about to go sit on the back porch, she says,
pushing past me with two mugs. I follow her out to a small concrete pad overlooking a weedy lot of uneven dry earth. She sits and motions for me to take the rusty chair across from her.
Are you the man from the church they said they'd send by?
She finally asks. No.
Mrs. Green, she says,
not at all bothered by the fact that I'm a complete and total stranger who just entered her house. Eddie sniffs around my feet, then leaves the porch to inspect a patch of dry grass and growl at something. I nervously glance over my shoulder, afraid Mr. Green is about to garrote me. Is Mr. Green home, ma'am?
Mr. Green is in the Lord's arms now, bless his heart.
I'm sorry to hear that. Did you both live here?
Oh, no. Mr. Green and I lived in Linwood. I moved here shortly after he passed.
She seems utterly uninterested in why I'm here, but I need some kind of in to ask questions. I work for the government. I'm doing a background check on somebody who was applying for a job. I was wondering what you could tell me about the man who lived here before you. Eddie finds something new to attack and scuffles around in the dirt before dragging his prey to her feet. She reaches down and scratches behind his ears, taking an eternity to answer my question.
I didn't know the gentleman. I just spoke to a realtor. He'd moved out when we bought the place.
I see. Did he leave anything?
Just the television.
Did your neighbors ever mention him? Say anything interesting about him?
Not that I recall. I think they said he was hardly ever here and was surprised when I moved in.
That's interesting. It could mean the toy man was using this as a kind of safe house, assuming this was ever his house. Maybe this was just where he took his victims. Eddie jumps up and darts back into the yard to chase after something he's decided is very important. Did the police ever stop by here?
What for?
To ask questions about the man who lived here before. I still don't know his name,
unless it's Jeffrey L. Washington.
No, not that I recall. Is the man in trouble?
They don't tell me much. Was there anything odd about the house? Maybe you found something unusual? She gives me a sideways look.
You certainly ask peculiar questions, Mr. Cray.
Eddie marches back to her feet with a stick to chew on. Sorry, Mrs. Green. They give me peculiar questions. She waves it away.
It's no matter. People on the news are doing all sorts of peculiar things. Don't get me started about our president.
Don't worry, I won't. I look across the yard to the shed. What are you keeping there?
Just old things. Some of Mr. Green's belongings.
I'd love to have a look, but can't think of a way to ask that doesn't sound weird. What did Mr. Green do?
20 years he was in the Marine Corps. Then he worked for the post office. A good man. A good provider.
You have any children? She shakes her head.
No, sir. Just Mr. Green and I.
She gives Eddie a pat.
And Eddie.
The dog drops his snack and rubs his jaw against her hand. I lean over to get a better look at the object covered in saliva, and I'm struck by an observation a paleontologist once made to me. We have far more dinosaur species in the books than there probably actually were. The problem stems from the era in which we thought of dinosaurs merely as giant reptiles. Lizards have pretty linear life cycles. A baby crocodile looks almost exactly like a full-grown one. When paleontologists would come across two very different sets of bones, based on the reptile assumption, they'd deduce that this meant there were two very different species of dinosaur, when in fact it may have just been one, an adult form and a juvenile form. Although my specialty is computational biology, I know enough human anatomy to suspect that the bone Eddie is chewing on isn't from something that was on a kitchen table, or wandered into the backyard after getting hit by a car. It looks a lot like a child's rib. I pull a glove from my pocket and reach for the bone. Eddie growls at me, but gets pulled back by Mrs. Green. I hold the dark brown shard under the dim porch light for a better look, as cold water rushes through my veins.
I kept calling the city, says Mrs. Green. I told them bones were coming up from my yard after every rainstorm.
I gaze back into the shadows of her yard and see jagged shapes poking out of the ground. Everywhere. Chapter 27. Concerned Citizen. When I was on the hunt for Joe Vick, a man whose name I only discovered an hour before he nearly killed me, I learned that life was not like the movies. Law enforcement investigations take a long time. You can spend hours or days waiting for someone to even talk to you. And even when you have all the pieces of the puzzle and have laid them out for everyone to see, it can take months for them to even acknowledge that they're there. I had to break some laws to get Vic, and do some things I'm not particularly proud about. At one point, Montana prosecutors, frustrated that their suspect was dead and they didn't have anyone to try, seriously considered building a case around me with the idea of making me a scapegoat, claiming I interfered with a non-existent investigation. Thankfully, pressure from both the family members of the victims I discovered, who were all over television thanking me for bringing them closure, and the governor's office made it clear that I couldn't be painted as the bad guy. But even so, bad blood remained. I'd embarrassed agencies and made more than a few enemies among Joe Vick's friends, of which he had many. Some even in law enforcement, who couldn't reconcile the brutal serial killer with the man who sat at their dinner table. All of this is going through my head as I dial Detective Corman's number. He's treated me like a nuisance, but not an antagonist. Heck, he even gave me all those other case files, in case I could find something he hadn't.
I've asked Mrs. Green to take Eddie inside in order to keep him from ruining any more evidence. God knows how many human bones he's already gnawed on. Corman's voicemail picks up.
This is Corman. You know what to do.
I'd run the conversation through my head a half dozen times. I wasn't prepared for this. I try dialing again. It still goes to voicemail. Afraid he shut his phone off for the night, I call 911.
911, how may I assist you? Asks a woman.
Hello, I'm at 17658 Wimbledon. There are bones coming out of the ground. Can you send a police car by?
17658 Wimbledon?
I hear the sound of typing. Correct.
Okay. It looks like you'll need to take that up with animal control. I can redirect your call.
Wait, what?
If you're having a problem with an animal, you need to call animal control, she replies.
Who said anything about an animal?
According to our files, there have been 8 calls about a nuisance animal at 17658 Wimbledon dragging bones into the yard.
I look down at Eddie, and his nose smushed against the glass. Mrs. Green is giving me a knowing look. I lose my shit.
So you're not bothered that these are human remains? You're totally okay with the fact that I'm looking at enough material for at least 3 or 4 bodies?
She changes her tone, but not in the way I hoped.
Sir, we've sent a squad car by before. Unless you're qualified to make a forensic analysis, I'd appreciate it if you didn't take that tone with me.
My shit loses its shit.
Does a fucking doctorate in biology from MIT qualify me? How about 4 goddamn papers published in Human Origins?
I shine my flashlight on a small jawbone sticking out of the earth.
Unless you take a very speciesist definition of what's a human and a tribe of goddamn Neanderthal children got really, really fucking lost, we're looking at human remains. Unless the LAPD wants to come down here and tell me otherwise.
Mrs. Green is nodding her head and giving me a thumbs up. Detective Corman is not going to be too happy with me when the press get a hold of this 911 call and the transcript is released. I sound like an asshole, but the emergency dispatch comes across as incompetent.
Sir, we're sending a patrol car over now. In the meantime, I suggest you calm down.
It takes every bit of effort not to hurl my phone into the next yard. I'm still standing in the backyard, taking photos of the bones, when blue and red lights splash over the house and onto the tops of the trees. I've been careful not to step on anything that might break, but I want to be extra sure that I get as many pictures as I can before the crime lab takes over. The shed is calling to me, but I don't even dare enter the structure until the police have had a chance to examine it thoroughly. All I need is some trace DNA of mine to fall on the floor of the garage, and the toy man's attorneys will squeal with glee when it shows up in a report. I already went through hell with the attorneys representing Joe Vick's estate. The man had a lot of assets, and people eager to protect them and his reputation. A friendly prosecutor told me that Joe and his pals might have actually been the center of a methamphetamine ring in the area, which surprised me not in the least. There were so many weird things going on there. The sliding glass door opens behind me while I'm squatting down, examining the edge of a pelvis jutting out of the earth. It looked like the last several weeks of rainstorms eroded away the yard, which had probably not been watered since California started curtailing water during the drought, which has me wondering how long it'll be before other secrets start unburying themselves.
"Are you the one who called?" asks a young officer.
White, short blonde hair, he looks like he should be in a Boy Scout uniform, and seems dangerously malnourished for a cop. Eddie might even give him a good fight.
"Yes, officer," I reply as I stand up.
He flashes his powerful beam on the bone I was inspecting and stares at it for a moment.
"Hmm, looks like it might be a pig bone. We get those calls all the time."
Not again. He can't see me close my eyes and count to 10.
Officer, with all due respect,
fuck it.
Does that look like the extended ilium you'd find on a quadruped? I point to a round shape in the weeds. His flashlight drifts over and casts a blinding glare against the small, dull yellow dome of a skull with one orbital socket visible. "Holy shit," he mutters, then starts to walk forward. I gently grab his forearm before he steps on evidence. "Officer, look down." He spots the sharp rib bone stabbing out of the dirt. "Fuck." No kidding. He takes a large step back and calls into his radio. "This is 4421. I need homicide and an ME down here ASAP." "Affirmative," says a dispatcher. A moment later, a male voice squawks over his radio. "Long Beach, this better not be a quinceañera pig they buried in the backyard." Officer Russell, according to his name tag, turns to me and shakes his head. "Have you ever seen anything like this?" I have one hell of a story to tell him while we wait for everyone else to arrive. Chapter 28. Anonymous. Who is the toy man? 3 days after I snatched Eddie's gruesome snack from his mouth, I'm sitting at a conference table in LAPD headquarters as the lead detective, Cheryl Chen, explains the case to me as a courtesy, with an assist from Craig Seibel, an FBI agent out of their Los Angeles office. Corman is nowhere to be found, because the discovery at Wimbledon is being treated as a new case. Projected onto the screen at the end of the room is what I assume will be a horrifying slideshow of what they've found so far. Chen clicks a remote to the first image. Mrs. Green's backyard is sectioned off like an archaeological dig, as forensic specialists in white suits stand and kneel on metal platforms, carefully extracting the remains. "We've found 17 bodies so far. Many of them are mixed together, so we'll need DNA forensics to confirm that, as well as to identify them. The suspect buried them under about a foot of dirt, which was then covered with sod. The problem, as you pointed out in your notes, was that over the last several years, Mrs. Green's not watering the grass, and the fact that the house sits on a slight elevation, led to gradual erosion as the grass died and seasonal rain fell. This exposed the upper layer, which then was exposed even further as her dog decided to investigate the decomposing bodies." "How old are the children?" I ask. "According to our medical examiner, all are between 8 and 13. Sex is difficult to determine with certainty on the younger ones, but it appears they're all boys." "How far along is the DNA work?" "Our labs can answer some specific questions in days, but a broader analysis will take weeks." "I have access to a certified lab that can do a lot more a lot faster. Helping me solve the Joe Vick case was a laboratory that specialized in doing forensics for the CIA, identifying terrorists before and after they were blown up." "We are very happy with our lab," she says. "If you want an outside report, they'd be happy to assist." "Thank you. We'll let you know," Chen replies. In other words, drop it. For the LAPD, this is a delicate matter. Not only do they have a yard full of bodies an old woman tried telling them about 8 times, the fact that they only showed up when a white guy made the call makes it worse. But the really problematic aspect is that there are 17 dead children in one backyard, and neither the LAPD nor the FBI ever launched a formal investigation until they were found. I drove by the house before this meeting. I counted 12 news trucks. I didn't even know there were that many channels to carry the news. The question everyone is asking, who was living in the house? Interviews with neighbors are conflicting. There are 3 different descriptions of a black man seen around, as well as 1 white man seen less often, but still on multiple occasions. Chen takes me to the next series of slides. "We've found holes in the walls, possibly used for restraints, as well as the locks on the inside of the doors. Our forensics team has picked up some blood in the house, but that doesn't look like it was the primary killing area." "The shed?" I reply. "Yes. The floor and walls have been painted, but we picked up splatter underneath.
We've only had enough time to go over a few square feet. Removing blood and tissue from under there takes longer.
She clicks to a rough-looking section of concrete.
The foundation is 3 feet thick. We found a crack where blood had been accumulating. This could give us a timeline from the kills that we can match up with the decomposition of the bodies.
As blood trickled into the crack, it created a kind of sedimentary layer for each child that was killed. In addition to additional blood samples, it'll give them a secondary timeline.
What about the ceiling?
Chen clicks to the next slide. The roof of the shed is a collage of Dayglow splatters.
He didn't bother to conceal that.
He was in a hurry, I reply. Toy Man was only going to do the least amount of effort he had to, so the next homeowners didn't ask any immediate questions, but not enough to fool a dedicated investigation. This concerns me. Why was he so sloppy? Lonnie Franklin used an RV for a number of his murders and got less careful as he realized the cops didn't care about his victims. The Toy Man was choosing his victims much more cautiously. Leaving this much forensic evidence around suggests he either suddenly became careless or felt he had little reason to worry. Maybe the fact that we have no idea who he is, even though there are cops standing in his living room, suggests that there's more to the man.
That's pretty much what we have so far, which isn't much. All we know is what he left behind.
What about Artis? I ask.
He's been very cooperative. We're working on a sketch of what he recalled and trying to reach out to any other children who saw the suspect at the time. We'll see what the public comes forward and has to say. I suspect we might get another break sooner than later.
I'm not so sure. Even Lonnie Franklin's neighbors were hesitant to talk about him. His best friends suspected there was something going on, but they kept their mouths shut. Part of the fear in this area is that you never know if a murder is just a random slaying or an ordered hit. Talking to the cops could put you on a list you don't want to be on. Times have changed a lot in the community since the Grim Sleeper's heyday, but community police relations are at an all-time worst.
What is he? I ask Agent Cybele. Do you guys have a profile?
He shakes his head. Guys who kill in their own home usually don't go through all the trouble of making sure the property isn't in their own name. That's something a hitman would do. But he doesn't fit the profile of that. We've had zero leads from anyone to that effect.
He shrugs.
We don't have a clue.
What about the way the kids were murdered? I ask both of them.
Chen replies, We only have preliminary reports, but in a word, savage. These children were cut apart. But there's no evidence of sexual violation at the time of death. Perhaps before, but not after or during.
Artis says the guy was a molester.
Yes, but those may have been separate actions for the suspect. He might have molested them and then killed them later out of guilt or fear.
Cybele looks like he wants to say something, so I prompt him.
Your thoughts?
It's still unclear. Artis said he and none of the other kids recalled violence, other than when he tried to kill him, which suggests they were separate acts, he says hesitantly.
And that's where we differ, says Chen. I think he may have been grooming boys to be molested and then killing them to conceal the crime, whereas Cybele and his people think that the killing was the primary purpose.
Molesting boys without violence, but then murdering them as an afterthought, I ask her.
Correct.
I'm not sure if that jibes with the experience Artis described, but I keep my mouth shut. These are the experts.
Chen turns off the slideshow.
We appreciate your help in this investigation.
She says this as if there has been an investigation, and I called a tip line. But I let it slide.
Let me know if there's anything else I can do.
Right, says Chen. And if you have any other potential leads or ideas, please let me know directly.
Take it to her. Got it. A little territorial, but that's not my problem. I'll let you know if my computer models come up with anything else. Of course, more data would be useful.
Unfortunately, I'm limited to what I can share with the public.
Ah, I'm public.
Technically that's true, but there are also dispensations for bringing in outside experts. She's made it perfectly clear how she wants me to be viewed. I should let it go. Detective Chen, do you know how I came upon the bodies at Wimbledon? I believe Artis reached out to you, or a friend of his? Clearly she skimmed through that part of the notes I gave them. Not quite. I was contacted by the father of a boy who still hasn't been accounted for. I hold my fingers a few millimeters apart. When I came aboard, the case was this thin. There was zero to build on. But through some effort, I was able to find that house. Through the Toy Man story? Cybele asks. Yes, a rumor.
Mr. Cray, Chen interjects, we're very grateful for your help. We'll make sure you get the credit you are due. In the meantime, we're still trying to see if the killer is out there. Let's hold off on the awards ceremony until then.
For fuck's sake, I say. That's not my point.
What exactly is your point?
I have tools. I have resources. I can help.
And we have a very capable lab.
That's about 20 years behind the current state of the art. Ask your lab if they have anyone on staff who can do methylation marker analysis or can build a biome map.
We are first-rate in forensic investigation, she assures me.
I believe you, but I'm talking about tools that will take decades before they're available to you. I can give you access to them now. What I really want to say is that I can give them access to me.
We'll take that under consideration, she says, politely telling me to fuck off.
I resist the urge to shake my head. Did you get any prints off Christopher Bostrom's bike? She shuffles through her notes.
I don't think we picked that up, but it's been 10 years,
and I promise you nobody has ridden it in that time. Please?
Fine, she replies, as if granting me a favor.
Cybele gives her a glance, then decides to speak up. This hasn't been in the news, but we have gotten prints from the shed. Lots of them. This is the first time I'm hearing it.
And?
Zero matches. We've checked every database. None. And these aren't partials. Full prints.
So he doesn't have a record?
Not with those hands. Every utility bill, phone record, everything. It all leads nowhere. Fake names and fake companies. Bank records, zilch.
How does someone manage that kind of footprint in this day and age?
He shakes his head. Usually it'll eventually point back to some law firm or something, but not even that. We know even less than when we started.
Not quite, I reply. What makes you say that? Asks Chen. How many people know how to do that?
That sounds like a pretty big clue, but you don't need me to tell you that. You got it covered.
I know I'm an arrogant prick, but I think I fucking earned the right.
Let them carry on. I'm not going to sit on the sidelines, because I know he's out there, and he's much, much smarter than any of us really appreciates. Like Joe Vick, he'd been invisible, even though he was killing right in front of everyone. Now that bodies have begun to surface, his camouflage is showing its weaknesses.
Chapter 29. Overlook. I'm lying on my bed in my hotel room near the LA airport, talking to Jillian, whose face fills the screen of my laptop, backlit by the lights of Los Angeles, visible through the window. Looking at her has a calming effect on me. It's not just because her dark blonde hair and small-town haughty looks make my heart race. It's also because we've been through about the darkest thing you could imagine, and have a bond I don't think any other couple could understand. Although we're not technically a couple, we're both still trying to figure out what we are together. I've spent the last hour explaining everything that happened so far, guilty that I've been out of touch for the past few days.
So what do you think? I ask.
You're an arrogant asshole, she replies.
Gotta love that woman. She doesn't mince words. Other than that part.
What do you want me to say? You're full of yourself, and you need to head back to Austin and let the real cops figure this one out? because that's actually what I'm feeling you want me to say right now.
No. No. I mean, well, am I full of myself?
Yes, there is no doubt about that. But how many of your smart guy scientist friends aren't?
Fair point. But we also tend to be full of ourselves about areas we have no expertise in, I reply.
Are you telling them how to lift fingerprints or interview a suspect?
I don't mention the bicycle because I know what she means.
No, I'm just worried that it'll be Joe Vic all over again. Don't be. There was only one of him. But be concerned this is some guy you know nothing about.
Neither do they. That's what has me concerned.
What are you afraid of?
Leave it to her to get to the heart of the matter. They're going to dig up the bodies, do their tests, and just leave it an open case until something else happens.
As opposed to?
Being proactive.
Like traipsing through the woods in Montana looking for dead hitchhikers?
Basically. I mean, I'm sure they're all competent.
There's a backhanded compliment from the esteemed Dr. Theo Cray.
You know what I mean. She's sometimes a little too insightful, knowing which of my buttons to push.
Tell me what I mean.
This toy man has operated for almost a decade, at the very least. They didn't even know he existed, or that his victims were victims. We find his house, but not only is nobody home, his fingerprints, if they're his, don't lead anywhere.
And you don't think they can catch him?
I think, I start to explain, that if he was catchable, they'd be on to him right now. They seriously have zero leads, not even false ones. Of course that's going to change as people who have no clue call in and send them on wild goose chases. About the only thing going for them is they haven't made public the toy man angle to the murders. I'm not sure if that's the best idea, but it'll help them separate who's full of crap from who's not.
What if other witnesses come forward? She asks.
They had plenty over the years. And here's the other problem. This guy's last victim was a couple weeks ago, but the police aren't drawing a connection to that kid. It's like they want to believe that he had his spree, then died or went to prison somewhere else.
So you think he's still in the area?
I give her a small shrug. Depends on the size of the area we're talking about. I've been comparing maps of possible incidents with some other data and discovered something interesting.
Of course you have, she replies.
Don't make me spank you.
Don't tease. What did the brilliant Dr. Cray discover? Asks the breathless grad student in the tight sweater and short miniskirt.
She sees how this distracts me and starts to laugh.
How did you ever teach?
For one, they didn't dress like that. They looked like homeless people. Second, never mind. Can I explain what I found interesting?
Yes, sir.
When a predator overhunts an area and runs the risk of the population detecting his methods, like a herd of deer getting preyed upon by a wolf, the predator will ideally have a second population it can target, if there's an opportunity to do so. If the herd starts closing ranks, it'll move on, but keep checking back and see if their pattern changes. If the prey situation returns to normal, or if their prey's reaction made it clear they didn't even know how to respond, the predator will go back to hunting them. In some cases, even more boldly, because they're not cognizant of him.
So the toy man backed off, but kept an eye on the area?
Exactly. Los Angeles was just too target-rich to write off if he didn't have to. But I suspect he may have had a B site, an alternate location, either based upon some work or social pattern he had, or because he got to pick and choose. The former might create a stronger signal I could find. I mean, he'd be easier to find because he's not in a place where his actions could be so easily masked.
And they didn't jump all over this? She asks sarcastically. Theo, I barely know what you just said, and I was with you when you were searching for bodies and Joe Vic went ballistic.
Cops aren't dumb. Glenn was smart. Way smarter than he let me believe.
Yes, but even he didn't get you. And that may have cost him his life. A lot of lives.
We fall silent for a moment, thinking of Glenn. She speaks first.
So are you asking me for my permission to go after him? It's not mine to grant. Selfishly, I don't want you to put yourself in harm's way again, but I know you. I don't think you'd be able to let it drop, especially if he's out there hurting